Welcome to the New York Quarterly Session with Mr. Raymond Hammond. We all thank him for being here today. Mr. Raymond Hammond is a poet and a critic who originally from Virginia now resides in Brooklyn. He works at the Statue of Liberty NM as a law enforcement officer for half of the week, and then works as an editor-in-chief for the New York Quarterly the other half, so he's very, very busy. So we really thank him for being here. He holds an MA from NYU, where most of his classes were intense studies of poetics with William Packard at the Chelsea Gallery Diner over a hamburger. He has a chapter book of poems, The Glacial Reasoning, and a book of criticism, The Poetic Amusement, published by Anathetic Arts. And this is the book here. All right?
Okay.
So, Mr.
Thank you. Thank you for coming. This was a session that I actually requested to do. We were able to turn in some suggestions, and I really wanted to do this because the editorial voice is something that I feel is starting to wane in this country. And the main goal, if you get nothing else out of this session, is awareness. Awareness that there is such a thing as an editorial voice, because people just do not talk about it these days. How many in here have heard people talking about the editorial voice? One. That's terrific. Now, where are you all from? Since it's a smaller group than I had thought, where are you from? Let's start over here.
Vermont.
Oh, yeah, but like what magazine?
Oh,
are you with a magazine, or are you just...
We have a school literary review.
Okay.
Southeastern Louisiana University.
Are you an editor, or...?
Yeah. Yearbook.
Okay.
I'm not. I'm from Toronto, and I'm at journalism school there, but I'm actually in broadcast.
Okay, great.
From both from Detroit, Louisiana University, the South End, Italy,
okay. You as well?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm from NJIT.
Oh, okay. And are you on the staff there? Or?
Yeah, I'm a columnist for the paper.
Okay, great.
I'm from Christian Flick at Student Rapids.
Okay. As are you. Okay, I'm sorry. I'm a little hard of hearing.
I am from RPI. I am a magazine there. It's a split between literature and news.
Okay.
We're both from SUNY Plattsburgh. In upstate New York, we have all points North magazine in our school.
Okay. Is that literary?
No, it's just a regular editor.
Okay. And then
First
you guys.
Magazine.
First Inkling. Excellent. So, the presentation is going to focus on literary magazines. And I see we have a smattering of everybody in here, which is fine. But just know that the focus is going to be for literary magazines. So the key today is awareness of an editorial voice. The other goals, to define the editorial voice, and then to provide some tools for discovering and maintaining the magazine's editorial voice. We're going to go through it in a very orderly manner, hopefully. Now, if you do a Google search for editorial voice, even if you put it in quotes, the first 10 pages or so, you get almost the exact same percentage as we got in this room. I think there were two articles in the first 10 pages that actually talked about a magazine's editorial voice. The other voice that you find it talking about is that of the inner critic, the editorial voice, the inner critic, writers talking about the inner critic. Now, the thing about the inner critic is it becomes so much a part of you that it becomes intuition. It becomes intuitive when you're writing. And now we're talking about the writing voice. Okay? The other thing you find is the voice of the editor in the editorial. Limited to that. Not the whole magazine. You find these articles talking about the editor's voice within the editorial. Now, both of these things, today we're talking about the voice of the magazine as a whole. Sometimes I forget what I put on these slides. But both of these things are part of the magazine's editorial voice. Now, to really define voice, you can't. Okay? How many people in here are also creative writers? Okay. Have you discussed your writing voice?
Yeah, I have, because we have to take a feature writing class for it, so in that it's more creative writing.
But it's very undefinable.
Yeah.
Would you agree?
Yeah.
So is the magazine's editorial voice. It's the same way. So if you look it up in Longman's Dictionary of Poetic Terms, they come at it in a very unique way. They come at it with synonyms. And we're going to go through the three synonyms that they use. The first one is persona. The second one is tone. And the third one is vision. These aren't exact synonyms of voice, but they are, in a circumambient fashion, a synonym of voice. Now, we're going to go through each one of these. You're going to have plenty. I see some people are taking notes. You're going to have plenty of time to get stuff down, because there's going to be some long quotes coming up. And when we get to them, we're going to break them down, so you'll have time to write them down as we go. So, persona. Latin for mask. So it's the writing mask. The first person narrator. In other words, who is speaking in the text? The poem, the work of fiction, whatever. It doesn't necessarily have to be the author. The author can assume masks. My fiance, when I was preparing this, told me about somebody, and I forgot their name, who is famous for writing with 15 different personas. Sounds very confusing, but that's fine. You know, the persona is who you, the author, think you are when you're doing the writing. It's the attitude towards the self. And that's very important. The author's attitude toward the self. Now, tone. Tone is the author's attitude toward the subject matter or the audience. And here we're going to focus on subject matter. So, for a writer, it can be diction, argumentation, irony, metaphor, image. All of these techniques, the writing techniques that they put in, is the tone, sets the tone. And the tone is what is in the line written on the page. Now, when you're really talking about voice, what you're really talking about with voice is everything outside the line. These are specifics: persona, tone, vision. You can see them in the black on the white. Voice is a more abstract concept that really exists in the white around the black, if that makes any sense. And then vision is the author's attitude towards life and the world surrounding them. So in other words, it's their presentation to the world. So you have... Let's see what my next slide is. Okay. Persona, tone, and vision. Now let's take this to a three-part harmony and talk about how this applies to a magazine. Persona, how the magazine imagines itself to the reader. That's self. Tone, how the magazine presents the subject matter. For our purposes today, because we're talking about literary magazines, we're going to be talking about basically selection, but it's also going to include the editorials, the essays, articles, photo selections, everything. And then vision, how the magazine interfaces with the world, and that's the style that's presented, the visual. Now, here's the long quote. Don't write it down, because we're going to change it. And this, John Haynes, I actually quote him very near this quote in my book about line length. But this is from his A Field Guide to Contemporary Poetry and Poetics in 1980. And he says, "It is the voice of the poet, no two alike, that determines the line, rhythm, structure, everything. Once heard, the voice creates the environment of thought and feeling which we come to accept and believe as the unmistakable mark of the poet's work. The voice refined becomes the poet's style. Unfortunately, the voice is one thing that can't be taught or learned in any school or class, nor can it be counterfeited. It is discovered in the act of living and working and nourished until it becomes as much a part of the person as an arm or a leg. Now let's change it for magazines. And obviously the purple are the interjections. It is the editorial voice of the magazine, no two alike, that determines the selection of work, the tone, everything. Once heard, the editorial voice creates the environment of thought and feeling which we come to accept and believe in as an unmistakable mark of the magazine. The editorial voice refined becomes the magazine's style. Unfortunately, the voice is one thing that can't be taught or learned in any school or class, nor can it be counterfeited. It is discovered in the act of living and working and nourished until it becomes as much a part of each editor as an arm or leg. Now, we're going to come, that's the statement we're going to break up as we go through. But we're going back to three-part harmony just to refresh our memories. Self, selection, and style. How the magazine imagines itself, its self-awareness, its self-discovery. How it presents the subject matter, the selection of the material is what we're going to be focusing on. And then how it looks to the world, how it interfaces with the world, the style. Now, the awareness of self, the magazine as its own entity. We're going to take the first statement from that John Haynes statement. It is the editorial voice of the magazine, no two alike, that determines the selection of work, the tone, everything. Self. This is often defined by the founding editor or editors. Is anyone in here a founding editor? Excellent. Yeah, several. Excellent. Yeah, because this came up in our discussion outside. This is wonderful. This voice is often redefined or refined by subsequent editors. And we're going to come back to that statement a little later on. And it's good to do a checkup every 5 years or so, even if you're the founding editor. Just make sure you're still on track with what you're doing. How do we pinpoint the editorial voice, especially since it's such an amorphous thing? The process that we use at the New York Quarterly, and we did this exercise about 2 years ago, is very similar to conducting a marketing plan. And as part of a marketing plan, one thing you should do is create a tagline. Familiar with taglines? Taglines are, you boil the mission of what you're doing down to the very few words. Coke is the real thing. It's a tagline. There's one in New York that I think is wonderful. It's one of the best taglines I've ever heard. Anybody familiar with WFUV? It's an NPR station. Mm-hmm. What do they say?
Well, Fordham University.
It's Fordham University, right.
I don't know, but my friend's dad is the music director.
Oh, excellent. Well, you got to tell them that I love their tagline. They're Fordham University, which is a Jesuit university, which is very important to their tagline. Their tagline is, "Hear us at 90.7... WFUV.
Yeah.
Hear us, O Lord, etc., etc., etc. It combines the Jesuitness of the radio station with, listen to us, we're playing music. I think that's a brilliant one. Ours is, I'll tell you ours in a minute. It's not nearly as brilliant, but. Now, this is really important. Know the philosophy upon which the magazine was founded. I'm wondering what's coming up next. Let me just see. Okay. So there's three ways here. Know the philosophy upon upon which the magazine was founded, then survey of readers and staff, and then identify the place within the magazine community. Okay, I'm back on track now. Know the philosophy. Take classes and read books. You guys really have a founding father, right? In Ian, basically. So they are very well connected with their founding father. He is available to take classes with, to suggest books to read, to really know the philosophy. So to understand the editorial voice of a magazine, if you're just going into the magazine, is do some research on who founded the magazine. Why was it founded? And then, this is what I was saying outside. If you go to start a magazine, this is a pet peeve of mine, because they never work out. They don't work out because you don't have an editorial voice. Have a philosophy. Be doing something fresh and new. It's terrific to see new magazines start up, but so many of them fail simply because a group of people couldn't get published anywhere else, and they go, let's start a magazine and publish each other. And then guess what? It flops. Surprise, surprise. Build it on a foundation. If you build from a strong foundation up, then you have something to work with. Now, the survey. For us, we surveyed the readers, the staff, and those that were close to the magazine. It took us about 8 months to do this. We did it online. But the most important aspect of the survey that we used was we simply asked them to list the first five descriptors that immediately came to mind when they think of the magazine. First five words. Just enter them. And then what we did is we put these into a word cloud. Everybody familiar with word clouds? Okay. Wordle and all that good stuff. And this is the actual word cloud that we came up with. And I was very happy with this because this is right on track. When I came to the New York Quarterly, the founding editor was there. I was able to work directly with him for something like 8 years before he passed away and before I was left in charge. So this fit the vision of the magazine at the beginning. Now, one thing that was surprising to us here, New York Quarterly is an all poetry magazine. That's one thing that's kind of unique. We're kind of unique in that way. There are other all poetry magazines, but there's not many of us. But look at what one of the bigger words. It's not anywhere near this big, but poetry. It's kind of interesting. So we knew it was important to work poetry into the tagline. So what we came up with was poetry at the edge. And that really describes many of our authors live on the fringes of society, literally. Some of them live on the fringes of reality. But then the work, we publish work that people tell me constantly will not get published elsewhere. And sometimes because of the language, sometimes because of the actual content. So that's just us. That's part of our editorial voice. So being at the edge is part of that voice. So to really narrow down, it's just really a good exercise to really put what you're doing into as few a words as possible. Which is kind of like writing poetry, but there you go. Then the third element here about exploring the self and understanding the editorial voice is to identify the place within other publications. So, as an exercise with your editors on a regular basis, or as part of the survey, we did it as part of the survey, have the people, the respondents, list other magazines that they read. Then have them list the first five things that come to their mind about those other magazines. Because you're going to start finding commonality, and it's going to start placing you in the world of, I mean, how many literary magazines are there today?
College-based or?
No, period. I think CLMP is well over, the Council of Literary Magazines and Presses is well over 400. I think on any given day, there's like 1,000 literary magazines out there floating around that some of them start and stop the same week. Some of them have been around for 40 plus years like us. All important though. But know your place within that. Okay, we did that. We did that. Okay, presenting the editorial voice. Okay. Now we're up to selection. To refresh memory, once heard, the editorial voice creates the environment of thought and feeling which we come to accept and believe in as an unmistakable mark of the magazine. This is selection, part of the three-part harmony. Presenting the editorial voice of the magazine through the tone of the editorials and the articles, the selection of the work. Tone is often the responsibility of the editor-in-chief. How do you transmit this tone, though, to the other editors, and especially those who will be selecting the work? This is what's important. Now, with NYQ, we're very fortunate. Because people who come to us to volunteer usually come to us because they know the magazine already. So they're already familiar and have chosen us to come to. Colleges are a little different because you generally only have one or two where you are. So the people may or may not know what you're doing as well. So, three means to prepare editors and staff to work with the editorial voice. And the first and foremost thing is training. Training, training, training. The second is to work with the trainee's own work. And the third is to constantly talk about the editorial voice. Training. No matter the education, we get interns coming to us with MFAs. And guess what? They don't want to read our books. They don't want to listen to what we have to say. So we say bye-bye because if they're going to work for us, they have to know our editorial voice. And they don't know that. Even if they know the magazine, they don't know our editorial voice yet because there's a lot more to it. So everyone, despite education, experience, or position, and this goes for PhDs too. I've turned some PhDs away because of this. Everyone undergoes a training program, period. Even board members. Have them read as many back issues as possible. Sample across time, and then discuss with you how they see that editorial voice either being constant or changing over time. And then prepare a library of books that each trainee must read that addresses the editorial voice of the magazine. At NYQ, there's four. The Art of Poetry Writing by William Packard. He's the founding editor. Of course we're going to have that one on there. The ABC of Reading by Ezra Pound. We really only make them read the first half of that book. But anybody in here read it? Go read it. It's really important. Melopoeia, Thanopoeia, and Logopoeia. Sight, sound, and sense. Which actually corresponds back to persona, tone, and vision. But it was a little too complicated to work it into the lecture. Very important, though. The last half is Pound just kind of espousing his smartness. Letters to a Young Poet. Just by show of hands, who has read Letters to a Young Poet? Has anyone? Yeah. This is why we have them. It really has nothing to do with the editorial voice. We just think it's important that people read this book. If they're going to be in creative writing or editing, they should read Letters to a Young Poet. And most colleges nowadays don't require reading of Letters to a Young Poet. It's beyond me. And then the last one, guess who? The current editor's book, Poetic Amusement. Now, for 10 years, this book floated around the magazine just as a PDF file. I didn't have it actually formulated into a publishable book. But now we provide people with copies. I can't bring myself to say, you want to work for me? Go buy my book. I don't do that. So that's why we build a library. And in the case of my book, give them copies. I had an experience with that at Vermont College. I went to Vermont College and I met Roger Weingarten. And I went in and talked to him about their MFA program. He goes, here's my book, go read it. That'll be $16.95. I couldn't believe it. So it's near and dear to my heart. Then, after they've read the books, hopefully, over a time period, so like over the time span of 4 weeks, you would meet once a week, and they would read one book a week. And all these books are short. They're all quick reads. Have them meet with you several times over to discuss the books that you had them read and how the books apply to the editorial voice. Then, when you put them on your screening committee, watch them. Don't just turn them loose. Watch them. See what their submissions that they're passing along comes in, and then take them to the side and say, this is right, this is wrong. And there is a right and wrong for editorial voice. Okay? It doesn't mean the poems are bad or good. Let me emphasize that. We're not judging bad or good. We're judging how well the poems fit the editorial voice. There could be perfectly good poems that don't fit the voice of the magazine that get rejected. Of course, there can be really bad poems too, like the one, I really wish I had kept a copy of this one, but it was about a gerbil being snatched out of a cage by the nefarious German shepherd, and well, it didn't end well. And neither was it written well. And then prepare a handout that outlines what you think the editorial voice of the magazine is. Have them meet with the other editors and see. Let the other editors give their take, because they may come at it in a completely different direction than you. Now, what I was talking about with their work, if they are also a creative writing person, if they are also a writer, an author themselves, sit down with them and say, this is what I mean by our editorial voice, while they're looking at their own work. Because the best learning experience is self-discovery. So if they're looking at their own work, and if they can make these calls on their own work, then they're going to make calls on other people's work. Now, this last one is really, really important. And unfortunately, she left. But we had one person in here who had discussed editorial voice. It should be discussed every time you get together on some level. It should be constantly put in front of the staff, the editors. Why? Because not only is it going to be involved in your selection, in the tone, in the articles, it's very much an important part of business decisions. When we decided to start NYQ Books, it was very important to us to keep the editorial voice the same. That influenced a number of decisions that were made, such as, are we going to have open submissions? No, we do not have open submissions to our books. Why? We have a whole pool of people to pick from the magazine, people we've published in the magazine. So one of the business decisions was, we will only solicit work from the pool of people who have already been published in the magazine. And that has served us well. And it served the editorial voice very well of continuing it to the books. Are we at 30 minutes?
It's getting close.
Okay.
You have 8 minutes until the session officially ends, but we started a little late, so you can go.
Okay. And like I said, this last one is just routinely keep it out in front of everybody. Talk, talk, talk. This should be an important part of every meeting, talking about the editorial voice and the mission of the magazine. Okay. Oh, and I just threw this in case we really had time to go over it. But it's also good to share with your potential authors, people who will be submitting to you. Kind of give them a clue as to some things that you're looking for in your selection process. Not that anybody who's submitted to us has ever read this, I don't think. Given we get 50,000 submissions a year, so it's kind of crazy. Now, two areas of concern that I have with the editorial voice that are trending in America today. The first one is contests. We do not have contests. I could do a whole nother session on contests, but I won't right now. The second one is credentials. Now, with contests, in effect, if you have a guest judge, you're in effect giving control of your editorial voice over to the guest judge. Okay? And more importantly, you're putting together a magazine. You've got an award-winning poem going into this issue. What are people going to see when they look at that issue? Which poem in that issue is going to stand out as the most exemplary of your editorial voice? The one that won the award. And oftentimes, the editors aren't even in charge of picking it. They give that over to somebody else. And then, unless you put a caveat in there in your guidelines, which people are starting to do, and I don't know how I feel about this, because people could just take the money and run. Have you seen this in contests where there's a caveat that says, and we reserve the right not to choose a winner? Yeah, that's aside from those people who are taking the money and running, you must publish the poem that's chosen, no matter how good or bad it is. Now, the remedy for contests: carefully choose the guest judge. Don't just choose them because they're available that day. Choose them because you would publish their work. Okay? If you would publish their work, then they're going to be more in line with your editorial voice already. Then provide them with the same handout you give to your editors. Oh, I thought there was a fourth one, but I guess there isn't. Now, this one is really dangerous. Contests are contests. Credentials is really a bad thing. Do you know what I'm talking about? Does anybody know what I'm talking about yet? Okay. Publishing based upon an author's CV rather than the work. When you're selecting the work because somebody won X amount of awards, went to Harvard instead of Yale, or teaches at this place instead of that place. When you start making decisions based upon the curriculum vitae instead of what the poem actually looks like or the story actually looks like, you're in trouble. And this is happening more and more. As the MFA programs proliferate around the country, we're seeing more and more credential-based decisions being made. And this is a slippery slope because it means the editors are losing control. It also means there's a lot of lazy editing going on, because it's so much easier to say, well, this person has 10 awards, I'll publish them. This poor person is on death row and sent me this on a napkin, I'm not going to publish them. When maybe, for the voice of your magazine, it should be the other way around. We had this happen about a year ago. A person who shall remain nameless, who we published, their partner had sent in some work, and I knew that this was this person's partner, and I knew that this Pardner is a big up-and-comer in the poetry world. So I really looked at their work. I really looked at it. And it just didn't fit the voice of the magazine. So I rejected it. Don't you know, a week later, I got an email from the poet we did publish saying, "Do you know who this person is?" And they actually had a CV attached to their email. When I wrote them back and said, "Yeah, I already knew all that when I rejected the work, they just need to not be so prosaic," they never spoke to me again. But that's all right. Just because they are famous or have won contests does not mean that their work will fit the voice. Okay. And this is important. If you care more about the CV than the work itself, then you probably do not have a very well-defined editorial voice. I'm leaving here shortly to go to a screening session in Brooklyn, actually. At the screening session, we don't have these very often simply because now the majority of our submissions are online. And people do those from their homes. But at the screening sessions, cover letters, when we open up a submission packet, cover letters go into a stack and do not get read. We don't care. That's how we guard against this. We only look at the poems. Now, I need to set this against solicitation because so many magazines do depend on solicitation. Solicitation is different. Solicitation is, okay, I like Billy Collins' work, so I'm going to ask Billy Collins for some poems for my magazine. You already know their work. Chances are the work they send is going to fit the voice of your magazine. That's different from selecting based upon curriculum vitae. But some things to guard against with solicitation. Oftentimes, especially the bigger name the poets are, they will send you their B-level work. Stuff they just want to get out, but they haven't really spent a lot of time on. Editors complain about this time and time and time again. We do not solicit work, basically. I would say, and we're pretty unique in this, some magazines are 100% solicitation. We are about 1 to 2% per issue solicitation. Everything else is open submissions. And for the most part, if they do send you B work, guess what? To stay on good footing with this person, you got to publish something because you asked for it. So you're kind of stuck. What do you think the remedy is for credentials? Don't do it. Throw those cover letters away. Read the work. If it fits the magazine, put it in. If it doesn't fit the magazine, they're out of there. Look at the work, not the name. Now, if you choose to solicit work to guard against what we talked about, when you send a solicitation letter, have the guts to say something along this lines: "I will choose from the poems that you send," or "If I find something that fits the voice of the magazine," leave yourself a way out. Because what I have found in the past, and I have solicited work and I have rejected work that was solicited, be honest, be blatant. Ultimately, they may be pissed, but they will respect it. So don't put yourself in a position when you send out a solicitation letter of having to publish something that they send. Always put little caveats somewhere in your letter, such as this: "I will choose from these poems," or "if it fits the voice." Let's see. Style. Style, of course, includes all that we've been talking about. In keeping with the three S's, we're going to do visual. Style basically is everything. If somebody picks up a book or goes online to a website, they can immediately identify it as New York Quarterly. That's what we're talking about. The fonts, the paper stock, color, texture, website, size, layout, cover art, what's included, what's not included, color schemes and logos. And if you're a print journal, please make sure your print journal jives in style, logo, color scheme, font with your website. It's going to go a long way. That actually is is a part of your brand. In marketing terms, that is part of your brand. The key is continuity. You want somebody to be able to spot your journal across the room. Okay, and then we come to the part, unfortunately, the voice is one thing that can't be taught or learned in any school or class, nor can it be counterfeited. But it can be examined, and people can be made aware of it. And that's what we're talking about. Training, experience, gain as much experience. Let's see what's next. Yeah, our transition. I had the great fortune to work with William Packard. William Packard founded the magazine in 1969. The first craft interview was with W.H. Auden. He remained the editor until 2002. I began working with him in 1994. So there was approximately 8 years there where I was able to work with him directly, study, and learn. One problem with college journals is you only got a couple years at best to get people up to snuff. Okay, so you really got to hit it quick and hard and give them, it's like intensive, because you don't have the luxury of years. You only have one or two to get these people turned around. And it's possible. It's not possible. Just be cognizant that you need to do it. And that's training and awareness. And then also realize that each new editor will bring something fresh to the editorial voice, no matter how dedicated they are to the original editorial voice. I think I've done a pretty good job. I've been told I've done a pretty good job of maintaining the editorial voice of the New York Quarterly. But it's different. There's very subtle things that are different about it. And I know that. I'm aware of that. And so are the other people, and they're accepting of it. And then, so basically, to summarize all of this in one word, it is discovered in the act of living and working and nourished until it becomes as much a part of each editor as an arm or a leg. So what we've really been talking about here is ways to identify and develop your editorial intuition. And that's the final word. Thank you. Do we have time for questions or...
Maybe like 5 minutes.
Okay. Are there any questions or comments or concerns or? Yeah.
What's the process of trying to find a voice in a piece that comes in?
It's built on the intuition. This is why we are so focused on the training and getting it ingrained in other ways. Because basically you're sitting there, you're reading. And what we want our editors to be able to do is read the first couple of lines. Again, we're limiting this to poetry because that's my experience. But read the first couple of lines and then know if they want to read any more. And if they're not interested in reading any more, it just doesn't jive with them. It doesn't agree with them. So it's only after what they do is they'll go through and read like that. If they read the whole poem, they like it, then they can come to me, and then there's things like was on that slide about, you know, don't summarize, don't, you know, line breaks, don't use grandiose generalities. Then we can sit there and analyze specifics that are elements of that we see as part of the voice.
Right.
But the idea is intuition, to build the intuition. And that's why I think it's hard for college journals, because again, you've only got a couple years to build that.
Yeah.
I mean, I had 8 years to build it with Bill. And when I took over, I really didn't know that I could do it. But you know what was going on in my head was trust my intuition, because I was analyzing the hell out of this stuff. And I was overthinking it. when I relaxed and stepped back, I was able to say, oh yeah, that's good. Okay, that's not good. It's all about building that intuition. Yes?
What's the difference between an editorial voice and a theme of a current issue?
The editorial voice could include theme issues. In other words, basically editorial voice is what do the people expect to see when they open your magazine? Do they expect to see a theme? Then that's a part of, we don't do theme issues. Nothing wrong with theme issues, we just don't do them. But do they expect to see a theme issue when they open up the magazine? That's part of the voice. Okay, so it's kind of a subset of. Now, you could have a theme as a whole of the magazine, saying, you know, you only publish poems by people who own basset hounds, for basset hound lovers. That could be part of the editorial voice too. That's a theme that's carried through all the issues. I don't know, it might last a while. Okay, other questions? Comments? Okay. Do you have something?
No, I was just going to say, do you ever see that in a given issue that there, the thematic elements of the poetry that make it into a specific issue seem to align in a certain way to kind of give the, you know, the illusion of having a theme for that issue?
No.
You never see that?
Because And I could see that happening. We publish so many poems. We put generally 100 to 125 poems in an issue. And they're so eclectic and varied in style, in everything, mm-hmm. that it's sometimes you'll start seeing a theme developing.
Yeah.
But I will generally break that up if I'm laying out the issue. Just because people don't want to see that who read the New York Quarterly doesn't mean they don't want to see it if they read another magazine. Mm-hmm. It's just that's not what they expect when they read the New York Quarterly. Oh, looks like it's time to go.
All right.
Anybody else? Thank you all so much.